But I'll try to make it. As accessible as I can, and please slow me down with questions. And I think the basic point, hopefully, will be I'll be able to make it clear and pretty simple. So, the object that I'm trying to study here are strongly coupled, what I call isolated conformal field theories in four dimensions. And though you don't have to stick to four dimensions to do what I'm doing here, what's important for many of the techniques is having eight or more supercharges. So, and I just, one aspect is I just want to tell you about a small sort of technical advance in how to compute certain properties of these conformal field theories. The list of what we can compute exactly about these strongly coupled conformal field theories is very short, so we don't have a lot of data about any given conformal field theory. But now, in the last few years, especially after the work of Gaiotto, we have constructions of enormous numbers. I mean, you know, many, infinitely many, I guess it's still probably still countably infinitely many families of these theories. And so we have the ability to start to look for patterns in some sense in the data that we have for these things. So I want to try to elucidate for you in some sense some general pattern of what's of what we seem to be seeing. So first we'll start by reminding you of some basics of N equals two field theories in four dimensions. That's kind of our setting. And then I will go on to talk about some of the techniques and what we learn about at least in, about some of these conformal field theories, and I'll try to illustrate them a little bit with the simplest examples. So there are indirect ways of getting at these at the properties of these theories through the sort of web of dualities type of argument. These are not direct calculations in some definition of the conformal field theory. They are in the nature of self conjectures that are then tested for their consistency. But as usual, the web of relations and ways of relating these theories to one another is very intricate. And so the sort of self-consistency checks are very compelling. There are also some less successful ideas about how, without using these, how you may be able to set up some sort of direct computations. Maybe this is a slight, slightly misleading, but anyway, you'll see what it is. And I'll talk about that, and then I will end with trying to summarize and what I think are some main open questions. So that's the outline. So let me start with the setting. So first, let's start with Lagrangian field theories, which we know about. With n equals 2 supersymmetry, it's a very sort of simple universe. I only have to describe a gauge group. And then one other thing, which is a representation of the gauge group, maybe reducible R. And those two pieces of data define the field theory for us. I'm interested in talking about conformal field theories, so there's some restrictions on what representations you can put in for them to be conformal. And because I'm looking for conformal theories, I'm not putting in mass terms. But you can, of course, then talk about deformations away from conformality if you want to. We'll come to that in a little bit. So for n equals 4 theories, right, there's no choice in the representation. It's just the adjoint. But for the n equals 2, there's this extra freedom to play. So
little level. So if we start adding high derivatives in Lagrangian, that a unique?
Well, I'm trying to write down scale invariant Lagrangian theories. So this is in flat space. So this is the set of Lagrangians that we know how to write down are just, you take a vector multiplier with gauge group G and a bunch of hypermultiples in representation R, and all their couplings are fixed. For each simple factor in the gauge group, there's one coupling constant.
But in principle, there can be ambiguities in the relevant couplings.
Of course, yeah. In every case, there are flat directions called the Coulomb branch, where you give a VEV to certain complex scalars in the vector multiplets, and they generically break the gauge group down to a bunch of U1s equal to the right of the gauge group. And so I'll draw a cartoon of this. So you can use the VEVs of these scalars as our coordinates, and this is some space, R complex dimensional space, and there's a point where U equals 0, which would be the conformal fixed point, but these are all vacua of that same theory. When U is not equal to 0, you spontaneously break conformal invariants. And at the generic point here, right, you have this a low energy Coulomb, U1 to the R, hence the name Coulomb branch. So this thing here is the Coulomb branch. So the hypermultiplets, if this is some reducible representation, there may be some flavor symmetry. Some global symmetry group rotating hypermultiplets for the matter among themselves. There's also always, from n equals 2 supersymmetry, a U2 R symmetry. So this is the non-R part of the global symmetry group of the theory. And there can exist a Higgs branch, separate from the Coulomb branch. I'll draw it like a cone or something like that, where the complex scalars in the hypermultiplets get this, and these are some other flat directions in these scalars. So, so let me just write this here. Q are complex scalars of the half hypers. So each hypermultiplet has four real scalars or two complex scalars, but the n equals two sort of irreducible representation is half of a hypermultiplet, which is like a chiral multiplet in n equals one dimension. It so happens that most of the simple models you write down always have half hypermultiplets doubled up, and so you generally see people talking about hypermultiplets in the literature. But it's in general, if you want to write down the most general models, you have to talk about the terms of half hypermultiplets. So I'll kind of use this language of half hypermultiplets. So on the Higgs branch, typically, well, first of all, you're getting BEVs to the hypers under which transform under the flavor symmetry. So typically, it breaks the flavor symmetry and spontaneously breaks the flavor symmetry and generically hazes the gauge group, and hence its name, Higgs branch. This is just generically, though. You can have special subsets of the hypermultiplets along which you don't completely hit the gauge group. Right? So there can be submanifolds of the Higgs branch along which it's not completely hit. And so this brings me to the thing that I really want to study, which is the following possibility. It can happen that there's a mixed Higgs and Coulomb branch. So it's something like this. In this picture, it would be this sort of plane that, I don't know if I'm drawing it clearly, but it has, in other words, there's a fiber over every point on the Coulomb branch in which some of the hypers get BEVs as well. So we have this Coulomb branch, and its dimension is R, the rank of the gauge group, and I'll call the fiber the mixed branch. Really, maybe the right name for the mixed branch is the full fiber across the Coulomb branch, and it has some complex dimension, which I'll just call H. Okay? And so the total space is an R plus H complex dimensional space of vacuum of such a theory. And on this space, on the Coulomb branch, the flavor symmetry is unbroken, but if I move off, then typically the flavor symmetry will be broken because I'm giving BEVs to some of the Qs. And these Qs generically do not break for this flat direction to exist, do not break this U1 to the R symmetry. So everywhere in the mixed branch, there's still an unbroken U1 to the R symmetry. So in some sense, this mixed branch is something that should also be called a Coulomb branch. Indeed, if you think about an n equals 4 field theory from this point of view, it's instead of having a, let's say, SU2 n equals 4 field theory, that's rank 1, it doesn't just have a 1 complex dimensional Coulomb phase, it has a 3 complex dimensional Coulomb phase. That's really, from the n equals 2 point of view, it's a mixed branch on that theory. So it's this mixed branch that I want to focus on. It's a it, you know, the whole manifold is smooth except for this sort of the singularities at the origin. And that's a very big statement. The technical point that I just wanted that I'm saying here is that in theories in which they would do have such a mixed branch, everything that you usually talk about in terms of the Coulomb branch, you should actually you should sort of lift to the whole mixed branch, and you just do the usual games of these S-duality predictions or these computations, taking into account the existence of these other flat directions, and you get a little bit of new data on the conformal field theory. So in some sense, that's the, on the technical side, that's all I'm saying on the new that I'm saying in this talk. So if you're an expert in these matters, that's all I would have to say. But let me give some examples. So the first thing to say is that these mixed branches are common. Let me just give some examples. So let me say the gauge group is SU2, and I have some matter representations
to half hypers in the triplet of SU2, which is the adjoint of SU2. Actually, this is the field content of N equals 4 SU2, but let's just, since this is the simplest example, let's just do it. So from the N equals 2 point of view, the flavor symmetry is the symmetry which rotates these two real representations. So it's also SU2 or SP1. And again, it gets enhanced when you for the this particular N equals 4 theory, but let's not worry about that. And then on the Coulomb branch, where SU2 is broken to U1, so this is on the Coulomb branch, a component of the three remains neutral. That is to say, we're just breaking by a diagonal generator of SU2. The weights of the three representation are +1, 0, and -1, right? The eigenvalues of it under that generator, SU2, so the zero of the three is neutral. And so as you move out on the Coulomb branch, you have one component of the hypermultiplet field, which is just a neutral hypermultiplet, and so it can get a BEV. It doesn't get, since it's not charged under the U1s, it doesn't generate a potential or anything like that. So neutral, that's the thing I was calling this, that this half hyper is Q. So there are two Qs, right? So therefore, we would say that the H is 2 for this resulting mixed branch, and these things transform in a 2 of SU2 of the flavor symmetry. Okay, and then the total mixed branch dimension. So the dimension of the mixed branch, which is just the rank plus H, is just 3 complex dimensional, which as I said before, that's the familiar moduli space of flat directions of the SU2 N equals 4 theory. Okay? So this was a very simple example in terms of the group theory is familiar to everybody, but it's special because it had this enhanced N equals 4 supersymmetry, but there are many other examples which don't have enhanced N equals 4 supersymmetry. So let me do a slightly less familiar example, just because it's going to play a role a little bit later. What if the gauge group was G2, the exceptional group G2, and I had 8 fundamental, so to speak, of G2 half hypers. So this is also a real representation of G2, so there's 8 of them. So the global symmetry, the flavor symmetry, is SP4 sometimes. That's the rank 4 symplectic group. Sometimes people call that SP8. If this had been a symplectic representation, then the flavor symmetry would have been SO8. The rules, you just have to, there's a certain coupling that appears in N equals 2 supersymmetry, how the, you know, if you write it in terms of N equals 1 superpotentials, you know, it's this Q, phi, Q twiddle type coupling. If you just look at the details of that, if these guys are in real representations, then the result, then it's the symplectic flavor symmetry that's preserved. So if you go out on the Coulomb branch, it's the same business here. You look at the weights of the 7 representation, and there is a 0 weight of the 7 representation. That's the same as saying that just like there is a 0 eigenvalue under the U1 here. So under this Cartan subalgebra, there are some 0 eigenvalues of the 7, which is, it's almost obvious that there has to be a 0 because, well, I don't know. If you're familiar with G2, it's just like SU3, the root system, so it has the same sort of symmetry. So everything's going to be in multiples of 3, all its vial orbits. So there has to be one left over sitting at the origin. So there's a component of the 7 which is neutral, which is what we call Q. And therefore, since there are 8 of these 7s, there's an 8 complex dimensional fiber in the mixed branch together with the 2 complex dimensional Coulomb branch. So there's a 10 complex dimensional total sort of Coulomb branch or mixed branch for this theory, for instance. And these guys transform in the 8-dimensional representation of SP4. So this is pretty simple. Another example, I won't go through the details, but I think you can work it out, is here is another conformal field theory. If you take SO5 with 6 vector representations, this has an SP3 thing and so forth. The 5 also has a 0 eigenvalue and so forth. So this would be another more obvious example with a mixed branch. And so I just wanted to go through those examples so that we, just to motivate the general group theory thing, which is if the representation, if a given representation of the gauge group has n 0 weights, 0 eigenvalues under the Cartan subalgebra, then it contributes n to the dimension of the fiber of the mixed branch. So it's very simple to see when a Lagrangian theory has these things. And the other thing to say is that representations which have 0 weights are fairly common. Basically, most representations do have 0 weights, except for the fundamentals and tensor products of just the fundamentals with themselves or just the anti-fundamentals with themselves in the SUN case. Because we're most familiar with the SUN, we know of a lot of representations which don't have 0 weights, but those are kind of the exception. So, okay, good. All of this has been for Lagrangian field theories, which is what I said I was not really interested in. But the above picture, not the group theory details, of course, but the above picture of the geometry of the Coulomb branch. The Coulomb, Higgs, and mixed branches extends to non-Lagrangian, or strongly coupled, n equals 2 conformal field theories.
How do I know that?
Well, it's just because the only way we really know about or can construct these non-Lagrangian conformal field theories, with the exception of one or two string constructions, is by embedding them in some, finding them as decoupling limits of a Lagrangian theory. We take an asymptotically free Lagrangian theory, and you tune mass parameters and couplings, and mass parameters and so forth, in such a way such that you flow down to an interacting conformal fixed point. Or you take a scale invariant n equals 2 theory, and you tune the an exactly marginal operator, the gauge coupling or something, to particular values. And then you can reach, you can find, and those become decoupling limits of these non-Lagrangian conformal field theories. So whether this is a general statement about all the space of some sense, all n equals 2 field theories or not, we don't know. But all the ones that we know how to get to certainly have the same features. So this idea that I just said of getting to the strongly coupled theories by taking decoupling limits from Lagrangian theories then leads you to going on that route, you can derive properties of the strongly coupled theories. So I will talk about predictions for these non-Lagrangian conformal field theories from S-duality. S-duality in this context just means this business of taking a Lagrangian conformal field theory that has, you know, so it's a Lagrangian theory with zero beta function, so the gauge coupling is exactly marginal, and I tune that to a special value where a factor decouples, which is going to be one of these strongly coupled conformal field theories. In some sense, it's like you take the call it the gauge coupling G, you take it to infinity. So it's like S-duality in n equals 4 theories. You take it, you have a weakly coupled theory, you take it to infinity, and you get a different theory in that. What exactly you mean by infinity is a little, well, it's a little ambiguous, but nevertheless, what we're saying is there's a point in coupling space where you can tune it to. So, and like I said, there's a huge zoology of examples now at our disposal. I will try to just give some examples from the simplest cases, which are when we use this to arrive at some rank one non-Lagrangian theory. So what does it mean for a non-Lagrangian theory to have a rank? Rank refers to the rank of the gauge group in the Lagrangian theory. Well, the rank of the gauge group was the complex dimension of the Coulomb branch. So when we talk about a non-Lagrangian theory having rank one, we just mean that it has a Coulomb branch of complex dimension one. Okay? So rank is somehow a misnomer, if you like. So so I guess what I'm going to say here is I'll do extremely brief review of rank one n equals two conformal field theories. So how do we describe, what do we know about these n equals two conformal field theories? Well, we know they're Seiberg-Witten curves, which is the low energy effective action on the Coulomb branch of these theories. So a brief review of that is, so here is your Coulomb branch with some coordinate u, right? And here is the conformal field theory at the origin. As we move out, it's broken, and it's a theory which, if it's rank one, it will just be a free U1 theory, but it will have a set of the couplings to any massive charge sources, tau, you know, the usual whatever it is, 1 over g squared type coupling. And that is expressed as the complex structure of some torus that varies over the U-plane. So all I have to write is an expression for this torus as a function of the parameter U. I'll leave a little space here. I can present it in, well, there's many different ways of doing it, but one is as this cubic in two variables. You can think of it as a double sheeted cover if X is on the Riemann sphere. So this as a Riemann surface is a torus, and I can parameterize the general torus in terms of the two functions, F and G, of the of this holomorphic functions of this coordinate U. So far I've been talking about conformal theories. I can turn on masses. To deform away from the conformal theory. It won't look as simple as this. There won't just be a singularity or one place where there are new light particles. There'll be various ones on the Coulomb bench. And we'll come back to that later. But for the moment, let's set the m's to 0, and we just have this form. So long ago, Minahan and Nemeshansky. So this is in like 96 or something. Notice that, well, if you want to describe all the this sort of rank one Seiberg-Witten data, you just have to describe the set of all the kind of classify the set of all these possible holomorphic dependents of a torus on one parameter. And this was done by Kodaira long ago, called the Kodaira classification. We're only interested in the conformal theories, so we're only really interested in when there's a singularity at the origin. And that's what Kodaira did. He classified the possible singularities that you could have here. And there's a couple of infinite series and six sort of exceptional series. The infinite series turn out all to correspond to known Lagrangian theories. Most of them are trivial, what we would call infrared-free conformal field theories. But the six exceptional ones are the interesting non-Lagrangian conformal field theories. And for the purposes of using S-duality instead of flowing down from asymptotically free theory, three of them are interesting. And these are the so-called E6, E7, and E8 singularities. Okay? They're not very complicated to write down. This is what would be called the E8 singularity. This is called the E7 singularity. I hope I'm doing this right. Yep. And this would be the E6 singularity. I put these in quotes, as we'll see. In some sense, these names for these singularities are a misnomer. They came about because Kodaira looked at these singularities and looked at their resolutions, and their resolutions in terms of had a structure which was reminiscent, corresponding to the, you know, the affine Dinkin diagrams associated with E8, E7, and E6. And then as we'll see, there's some relation to some properties in physics as well, but that relation's less clear. A more physical way of describing these singularities is by the scaling dimension of this variable on the Coulomb branch. Right? This is the VEV of some operator, and it's a scalar, actually chiral primary. In this conformal field theory, it has some definite scaling dimension, and the scaling dimensions in these three cases are 6, 4, and 3. So it's preferable to talk about these as the 6, 4, and 3 dimensional singularities, as I'll mention in a minute. Okay. So that's my lightning review of what we know of this Kodaira classification. And so these theories are these theories are interesting because they're only realized they're not realized by flowing down by doing RG flows from larger theories. You can only apparently there's no proof of this, but we only seem to be able to get to them by tuning marginal operators. So. So we get to these CFTs by tuning a coupling G in some Lagrangian field theory. And I'll give you the basic examples for the three cases. If you start, there are many actually, there's not just one way of getting to them. There's many different ways, but I'll try to give you, in some sense, the simplest examples. If you take SP3 with a 14 and 11 sixes, you go to the infinite coupling limit, you get, it becomes a weakly coupled, a decoupled version of an SP2 gauge theory and this, let's see, of this, of the E8 singularity here, where E8 now stands for the global symmetry group of this conformal field theory.
Are they the highest thinking numbers of each of the E8, E7, and E6, the algebra?
I don't know if that's true. Is it right?
It could.
Yeah, that could be
the.
I guess.
Yeah.
I know.
I know for E8 is true. I don't remember for E7.
Yeah, I think you're correct. But I will argue that this connection is completely
right.
Okay. That's probably one of the points. But I'd like to make.
Oh, I also wanted to say that. I mean, perhaps another reason why in the singularity theory, I mean, the deformation of these things are very controlled by the algebraic structure of E7, E7E. I mean, of the D algebra. I mean, the invariant theory is controlled by that. And it's not just that they look like the resolution looks like the.
The flavor symmetry has something to do with the complex deformations of the singularities, not the resolutions. And you're right, there is a maximal deformation of each of these singularities, which indeed controlled by E8, E7, E6, has the Bach, you know, their invariance under the Bach.
That's probably why the components like that.
Maybe Kodaira originally didn't. But
we sort of understand the connection between the two because these singularities can be lifted to these hyperkähler quotient singularities, and then there's a relation between the resolution and the deformation structure. But this is not true in general. The setting for n equals 2 conformal field theories, this is not true in general. And that's one of my main points. But let me just go through that, just write down this list so we can kind of compare and contrast with with a different construction, a different S-duality construction in a second. So here are three more or less simple examples. That realizes these rank one conformal field theories with E8, E7, and E6 flavor symmetry groups. So you can realize them by taking, in some sense, the infinite coupling limit of these Lagrangian theories. There's a sector with a pure weakly coupled Lagrangian sector which decouples, leading you with these conformal field theories. Okay. And there's some, and, well, okay. So, but there are also other, there are many Lagrangian theories which can take weak coupling limits, and you can try to do a systematic search and so forth. And I did this long ago with John Wittig. So this would be. And specifically looking for a rank one theories. And there are some surprises. So in particular, let's look at this theory. This is a rank two theory. Maybe I can back up. For instance, there are many matches. You know, when I write an equivalent, this S-duality relationship, it's in some sense conjectural. There are many checks on it, but there's no proof of it. But as an example of one of the more trivial checks is they have to have the same Coulomb branch. This is rank three, so it's a three-dimensional Coulomb branch. This is rank two, so it's a two-dimensional Coulomb branch, and this is a rank one, so it's one, so it's a total three. The dimensions are just the dimensions of the adjoint invariant, of the U's for SB3 are the dimensions of the adjoint invariant. That's 2, 4, and 6 for SB3. For SB2, it's 2 and 4, and it's 1, 6 here. So we see how they go together. If I try to do the same for G2, the adjoint invariants are dimension 2 and 6. Now, we actually know the curve for this theory. So we know that that there is a point where you go to strong coupling, where it's no long, where it decouples into sort of two factors. One has sort of a dimension two invariant. There's only one known conformal field theory with a dimension two invariant. That's the SU2 scale invariant SU2 theory. And then what is left, there's only one singularity with a dimension six invariant. So it has to be, and you can actually read it off, it's precisely what Federer called the E8 singularity. The surprise is that so there is some strong coupling limit here, but the surprise is that all the other checks, central charges and everything else like this, don't work for flavor symmetry E8. Instead, they work for a smaller flavor symmetry SB5. Okay. If there was just this one example, this tells us that there's got to be some different mass deformation of that singularity. Like I said, there's a web of dualities, and so there's many different ways of, there's many other examples, and even if you're not completely convinced, you say, well, it's just an algebraic mistake that all these checks worked out for this case, but then you find literally dozens of other cases which work out with precisely this SP5 flavor symmetry with all the special central charges and everything like this for this conformal field theory. So it's predicting a new rank one conformal field theory that we didn't know about before. And there's other.
SP5 and V8 is
neutral,
right?
When you turn the masses off, it's the same singularity. But these, when you turn these masses on, they'll be different. I'll give an example. I don't actually know how to construct the Seibert-Witten curve with the mass deformations for SP5. It's an algebraically, the direct way of trying to do it is algebraically extremely challenging. You get a set of a huge number of polynomial equations, which you have to solve simultaneously for many variables. I won't go into it. I'd be happy to talk about it in some detail. But we do have some cases where we have found the Seibert-Witten curve.
How big is the central charges at 18?
I could look it up for you.
But it's for the one. They all have small central charges.
Yeah.
So for example, for the EA theory, so 48 times the central charge A for the EA theory is 190, and here it turns out to be 164. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that means anything to you. We know, of course, large N generalizations of these series. Mm-hmm. We don't for these series. That's an open question. Is there some modification of the F theory type construction or of the ADS-CFT type construction, which would get these other definitions? So, let me give another example here. So SP2, which is, I guess, SO5, with 6 phis, which was the other example I put over there, so for instance, this also has a 2 and a 4 dimensional invariant, and it has a strong coupling point, which is going to be dimension 2, and then some conformal field theory with a dimension 4 invariant, which has to be what we call the E7 curve, and it turns out to have some funny flavor symmetry, nothing that you would necessarily guess off the top of your head. SP3D cross SU2. Okay. So these are some old results from 3 years ago. The only new thing I want to add is that the left hand sides have mixed branches, as I pointed out over there. And so the right-hand side will also have to have the mixed branches. So there's some extra sets of checks on both sides. And now, I won't go through all the algebraic checks that you get,
but it works I guess I have to give you a little bit more detail about what's going on here. Just to give an example of how these checks work and the new thing that we learn about these conformal field theories is that in this case the flavor symmetry we said was SP4. Here, this flavor symmetry is SP5, but at any finite coupling, the SU2 is gauging a subgroup of SP5. In this particular case, the commutant of the particular SU2 that's being gauged is SP4. So this part is gauged, and so we're left with a global SP4 symmetry. That's one of the many checks that you do in this sort of thing. And here we had, in the mixed branch, some complex neutral scalars transforming under the 8 of SP4, so they have to be doing it on that side. But as we see in the decoupling limit, that SP4 is part of the full flavor symmetry. So what we need then is that this full conformal field theory has its own mixed branch, which transforms in the 10 of the flavor symmetry of this theory, and which upon gauging the SU2 subfactor leaves you, lifts 2 of those 10 dimensions and leaves you with the 8 dimensional fiber over the Higgs, over the mixed branch here. And the fact that it's a 10, which turns out to be, you know, a symplectic representation of an SP5 with an odd index, means that there's a Z2 obstruction, you know, the Witten anomaly to trying to weakly gauge the SP5 flavor symmetry. This was something that was discovered by matching on the left and right sides before, and now it has sort of a natural explanation in terms of the fact that we see that there is that on the before it was just some by looking at trying to gauge the flavor symmetries on both sides, you saw that there was an obstruction on the left, and so you found that there had to be a Z2 obstruction in this conformal field theory, and now it's understood in terms of the existence of just the usual SU2 anomaly in this conformal field theory, given that this conformal field theory generically has this larger Coulomb branch, this mixed branch of higher dimension.
If you try to gauge the flavor symmetry, there are an odd number of seven, which are in a symplectic representation of SP4, so it turns out also to have an odd index.
I mean, there are many checks like this that you do on both sides too.
The web of Hofer doesn't appear inside the Kittel curve. It's a resolution parameter, right? It cannot be deformation
parameter. I don't think we have a clear understanding of how to what to do when you move off of the off of the Coulomb branch.
No, so I was just thinking U is a deformation parameter, then Q should be
on the mixed branches that I'm talking on the mixed branches, which you know where the fiber lies everywhere over the Coulomb branch. The structure is very simple. It is simply a product of the fiber cross the Seibert-Witten curve. So there is no Q dependence here.
That's
a
non resolution parameter. It's not deformation. Mass is a deformation parameter.
Yes.
But Q is a resolution. You're resolving, and then you're given sizes, no?
It's not quite like that. It's more like the Higgs branch that's located, which is a different branch of the Coulomb branch. Which, you know, this is not a fiber everywhere over the Coulomb branch. These Qs, the Qs, act as resolution. Might act as resolution parameters here. We actually don't have a good sort of theory of, by looking at these singularities, of understanding what are the Higgs branches that come out of the singularities. In a few cases, in fact, for the E8, E7, and E6 cases, we actually have a beautiful string theory picture that allows us to compute these Higgs branches. But I don't think we have a general understanding. It's something that would be nice to. But the basic idea is what that you're saying should somehow be, right? Something like a resolution parameter of this rigid, of this special Kähler geometry that's being described.
I think my time is almost up, and unfortunately, I haven't really gotten. Okay. So this is just an example. So we learned a little bit more data about these strongly coupled field theories, the existence of something about some of their Higgs branches that we didn't know before. You can go through the many examples that are known in the literature. They fix up a few cases which were in which there were questions before, and they work in the usual, you know, seemingly very intricate way that all these things check out. So basically, what you learn is whenever if you realize these theories by inestuality and there's a mixed branch on the left-hand side, there's got to be a mixed branch on the right-hand side. The converse isn't true. You can have mixed branches on the right-hand side, but if you're gauging an appropriate subgroup, you can completely lift those branches, and you might not see them on the left-hand side. But anyway, it's a new piece of data to take into account in this whole matching. So, so I was going to say a few things about instead of trying to realize these things through S-dualities, to try to, maybe this thing moves up. To try to look at them directly. One is that there's a sort of an algebra. One nice way of getting at this is you can take the low energy n equals 2 theory and twist it and do the topological projection, and then you put it on general backgrounds and use this as a way of extracting the dependence of various central charges because they're sensitive to certain curvature invariants or of the background space-time geometry or of a gauge bundle over that geometry coming from weakly gauging the Flavor symmetry. And so you can read off various central charges and relate them to data in the Seiberg-Witten curve. And this goes back to, of course, original papers by Witten and, lots of people have worked on it. And most recently, Shapir and Tachikawa use this to compute many this kind of idea to compute to make this connection for central charges for conformal field theories. And what I'm just saying is take their arguments and extend them to include the existence of these neutral hypermultiplets on the mixed branches, and you get some interesting relations from this in the that, for instance, the dimension of this mixed branch is twice the dimension of that complex scalar minus the central charge of the Flavor algebra appropriately normalized. It so happens for the E8, E7, and E6 cases, there was this sort of mysterious identification where the Flavor central charge just happened to be equal to twice the dimension, 2 times 6, 2 times 4, and 2 times 3, and it worked actually for even the large N versions of these things, and so we had no. And here we're saying, well, there are other examples where this relation doesn't have to hold anymore, and that corresponds to the existence of these extra flat directions. I'm going to skip any discussion of the details of this. I just want to say one other thing, which was there was the question of, well, what do the actual deformations of these curves look like? How are they different? Whether you did an E6 mass deformation or some other deformation, I'll do the E6 case just because it has the fewest invariants, so it's simplest to write down. Let's see. So this will be the Seiberg-Witten curves of different mass deformations of the E6 singularity. One deformation is easy to write down. What we had here, right, was U to the fourth. This was the singularity. All you want to do is to write down general polynomials, basically, such that they don't destroy this singularity when their coefficients. So we're going to put in now general, these are F and G functions with some mass parameters. And so the most general one that you can write down that is sort of gives a deformation of this singularity is is the following polynomial with six coefficients, six independent coefficients. Their subscripts tells you about their scaling dimensions. They have to be, this means this has to be a quadratic polynomial in the bare masses MI, a fifth order, an eighth order, and so forth. The scaling dimensions are easily just read off from what the scaling dimensions of U are and what X has to be just to make the whole thing homogeneous. And these things are, these dimensions, 2, 5, 6, 8, 9, and 12, are the dimensions of the independent adjoint invariants of E6, right? This is not a complete, this isn't a proof, but you can actually, the curve is only half the story. There's the Seiberg-Witten 1 form, in other words, the full special Kähler structure that you have to get. And then you find that indeed these things are precisely the set of built out of bare masses in terms of a set of Weyl invariants of the Weyl group of E6. So it, the E6 symmetry organizes the BPS states and of this theory. Great. So this is, that would be the case with E6. And this was known, as I said, by Minahan and Nemeshansky. And the Seiberg-Witten 1 form was constructed. John Wittig and I have constructed another deformation, an independent deformation here. Let me see how to write this. It will be a little complicated looking, just to give you an example, I guess. So delta, let's see, and I just have to tell you what delta and gamma are. Delta is a two-dimensional mass invariant, and gamma is u plus u squared plus a six-dimensional mass invariant. And as I think I mentioned before, 2 and 6 are the exponents or exponents plus one of G2. So this might be an indication that this deformation it realizes a G2 flavor symmetry for this curve. And I mean, so there's, you know, it's difficult enough to find a deformation which has some right sort of factorization properties for the discriminant. This does the job, and you could just check it on Mathematica or something. Much more difficult is then to construct, to show that there also exists an associated Seiberg-Witten 1 form, that this is not just an arbitrary complex deformation, but it preserves a rigid special Kähler geometry on the Coulomb branch. And you do that, and you find everything is, these M2 and M6 are, in fact, the invariants under the Weyl group of G2. So indeed, this has a G2 symmetry. And furthermore, this deformation cannot be found from this deformation by just tuning some masses. I mean, I can obviously, because this is the most general parameterization, pick values for M2, M5, M8, M6, M9, and M12 to match this. However, these guys are polynomials in six, you know, bare masses, if you like, or sort of individual masses of the hypers here. And there's no choice of those six guys which will create these polynomials. Another way of saying it is there is no adjoint breaking of E6 which realizes G2. Okay? So these are two distinct deformations of this dimension 3 singularity with different two, preserving a rigid special Kähler structure on the Coulomb branch. Presumably, the same will be true for these other deformations here. A direct attempt to construct the curves like this is turns out to be very difficult. So we're more or less stumped by how to actually try to construct those curves. And it's something we would like to we need some new idea. We can construct a curve like this and another deformation that we have. We found almost by luck, by a set of tricks called, there's certain isogenies between Riemann surfaces in which they're kind of classical isogenies. Their algebraic form had been worked out a couple centuries ago or something. And we could just use those, and those were able to give us these special sub-deformations. But the general search is just looks very difficult. So now I know I'm a little over, so let me just summarize and tell you what I think are the main points here. I seem to have lost my... did I leave it on? Oh, up here. So the main point that I want to make is there's an analogy between the Lagrangian and non-Lagrangian conformal field theories that we find. On the Lagrangian side, everything was organized in terms of a gauge group and its representations. But the, which is some very simple data, and then there's some straightforward algebraic way of going from this to deduce the things that we can sort of observe in the conformal field theories, anomalous dimensions, central charges, flavor symmetries, dimensions of Higgs branches. And on the non-Lagrangian side, of course, all we know are those gauge invariant objects. And it's the sort of the thing, the singularity of the curve plays the role of the sort of the gauge group data, and the deformations of the curve play the role of the representation content. And, you know, I guess the basic point is, in the Lagrangian theory, you can have one gauge group, and there's a bunch of different choices for representation content that gives you a conformal field theory, right? And then you, once you know that, you get different flavor symmetries and so forth. In the same way here, once you turn off the mass deformations, you get a singularity. And the pattern seems to be that the same singularity has different deformations, and in the cases where it's a Lagrangian theory, you get the same singularity for the same gauge group, okay, and the different deformations are reflective of the different matter content. And in fact, you know, the simplest example done, in the original papers by Seiberg and Witten, they describe two different mass deformations of SU2, one with the four fundamentals, or the n equals four deformation, one with the adjoint, right? It was the same singularity. There was just two different ways of turning on the mass deformations of that curve. So that's the pattern we've understood in the Lagrangian cases, and it's repeated also for the non-Lagrangian theories. You have some singularity, and you have a set of different deformations, and there's quite a complicated pattern. So from these things, you get a flavor symmetry, for instance. And in Lagrangian theories, you know, the flavor symmetries are all fairly simple. They're all classical gauge groups, SU, SP, SO, in certain combinations. And when you do it here, you also get flavor symmetry. Sometimes they're all classical gauge groups, but I mean, not Lie groups. But other times that there are these exceptional ones, like these E6, E7, E8, or the G2 that we found and so forth. So an obvious question, so this is the lesson to take home. There is at the level of what we can compute of these non-Lagrangian conformal field theory, they have a structure which is reminiscent of this gauge group representation structure. And so an obvious question is there some generalization of this algebraic structure of a Lie algebra and its representations, of a reductive Lie algebra and its representation, that would, with the same, you know, same sort of algebraic rules, would give us some of the data that we find for these non-Lagrangian conformal field theories. So I'll just leave it at that. There are very other closely related questions to what I just said. One is this question here: is there a more efficient construction of the special Kähler deformations of singularities? And are there ways of, in the question that you raised earlier, are there ways of understanding the Higgs branch, the isolated Higgs branches which stick out of singularities from resolutions or deformations of curves? And, okay, I think I'll leave it at that. Thanks. There's this Kodaira
classification of singularities in the rank one case, and it has an ADE structure plus three extra ones which don't fit into any nice ADD. You can try to generalize Kodaira to rank two, something that I did some years ago, not successfully. I mean, we found them. It's a horrendous mess, but we found many, you know, isolated singularities at higher rank, you know, a list of, you know, 100 or so of them. They don't seem to satisfy any nice analog of an ADE type classification or anything like that. In higher rank, you know, it's not just a generalization to say what are possible singularities for families of genus 2 Riemann surfaces that depend holomorphically on two complex parameters. You have to, in addition, now there's non-trivial constraints on the curve starting at genus 2 due to saying that it's not just general complex singularities, but you want ones that satisfy the constraints of this special Kähler structure. So it's a problem which just hasn't really been looked at in the math community.
What about non-Lagrangian theories in three dimensions of this type?
So there is so I don't know the full story. I don't think it's quite as well explored. On the one hand, the structures from of this type means n equals 4 supersymmetry in three dimensions, right? That the structure of the flat directions is much more rigid. They all have a kind of a hyper-Kähler type structure, but even there, the general construction of hyper-Kähler manifolds is, we don't have, it's not in much better shape than the general construction of special Kähler geometries.
You know, there's some simple things in three dimensions, which, for instance, you can take infrared-free four-dimensional n equals two theories, and there are many. You just take, let's say, SU2, and you just put in too much massless matter, right? So the beta function, so it runs to the free in the infrared, but then now you do a dimensional reduction, or rather you compactify in a circle, and you can flow down to whole sets, complicated sets of non-trivial three-dimensional fixed points in this way. And they have all sorts of complicated flavor symmetries and so forth that you can read off very simply from their four-dimensional parents, because those are free field theories. So if anything, I think the lesson is that that in lower dimensions, the possibilities kind of explode. Mm-hmm. How are you? Good. Yeah. Till the end of the month, so another 3 weeks. Yeah. And you?